WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
On Sunday in Northern Ireland, a powerful bomb turned a memorial service for Britain's war dead into a tragedy. The IRA has taken responsibility for the explosion, which killed 11 and wounded 55 others. My guest, Chicago-based journalist John Conroy, has written about how ordinary life in Northern Ireland has changed as a result of the violence. In his new book, Belfast Diary, War as a Way of Life, Conroy says that his intention was to write a street-level view of the war, to provide a context for the casualty reports, to explain the war in terms of ordinary human beings and the pressures placed upon them. With a grant from the Alicia Patterson Foundation, he spent 1980 living in a Catholic neighborhood in West Belfast. He also spent considerable time over the next 4 years freelancing from Belfast for American newspapers and magazines. He's currently a staff writer for the Chicago Reader. I spoke with John Conroy earlier today from the NPR Bureau in Chicago. Sunday's bombing was the most destructive Irish terrorist attack in 5 years. Some observers are speculating that the bombing was intended as a show of force in the light of recent IRA setbacks. Several IRA arms shipments have been captured over the past year, and several IRA soldiers have been killed. I asked John Conroy why he thinks the IRA chose this time to stage an attack.
I think that we can analyze these things day by day and wonder what the IRA is going to do next, but the fact is that the British Army itself has concluded that the IRA will be there as long as the British Army is there. And so yesterday's attack, while it comes as a surprise in the number of civilians killed, because the IRA doesn't usually kill civilians, it comes as no surprise in the sense that their effort continues, and it will be here for generations as long as the British are in Northern Ireland.
You know, I think the IRA's profile is one of a terrorist group that doesn't discriminate about who it kills.
I think you're right that that is the profile, but I think that if, as I go into my book, I lived in that community for a good long period of time in the ghetto in Northern Ireland, and the people there have a great sense of morality and ethics, and you can see it in the IRA's operations, and this is not a radical statement. It's the statement made by the British Army in an intelligence document leaked to the press in 1978, in which a Brigadier General James Glover says that the IRA has a code of ethics. It will kill soldiers and policemen. It won't kill the wives of soldiers and policemen.
I think it's difficult for many of us here in America to understand why the IRA is a terrorist group, why it does use violence as part of its tactics.
I think you're right, Terry, that it is difficult for Americans to understand it, because I think Americans have forgotten that this nation won independence through violent means. And the IRA, whether they're right or wrong, looks to the history of Northern Ireland, the history of Ireland, rather, and sees that violence works. Violence won independence for the south of Ireland. It was violence. It was the threat of Protestant violence in the north that's responsible for the creation of the state of Northern Ireland. It was violence, Protestant violence again, that felled a power-sharing government in the early 1970s, a government set up so that Catholics and Protestants could share power. So there's ample precedent for this notion that violence changes things in Ireland.
Why did you want to go to Northern Ireland and report from there?
I went there first in 1977 as a journalist, and I realized that nobody was there, that no American newspaper or television station had a bureau in Northern Ireland, that everyone was picking up wire copy, that the coverage was much like the coverage of yesterday's incident. We'll hear about this incident today and tomorrow, but we won't hear about it on Wednesday and Thursday. Northern Ireland will not be on anyone's mind come the end of this week. And I thought that this sort of news coverage presents a very distorted picture of what's going on there, that we react to the atrocity, we don't react to the cause of the atrocity. We react to the IRA as the cause of the problems in Northern Ireland, not as a symptom of the problems in Northern Ireland. So I went there to write about how ordinary people were living, with the idea that if you could understand the pressures on the street there, you could understand why an 18-year-old picks up a gun and shoots a policeman in Belfast, when 18-year-old Catholics aren't picking up guns and shooting policemen in Chicago or Boston or Detroit or Paris or London.
You know, one of the things that surprised me in your book was the fact that there were no bureaus from American newspapers in Northern Ireland.
That was a shock to me as well.
Is that still the case?
Pardon?
Is that still the case?
Yes, it is. It's a very difficult war to report because it's not as if you can go to the trenches as you can in Afghanistan and get great footage or casualty copy. It's a war of attrition. So long time passes when nothing's going on or seemingly nothing. You have to stop and look at what's causing it. And it's very difficult to stop and look at what's causing it when you're trying to report news on a daily basis.
It was your intention to stay in a neutral area, but you ended up staying in a Catholic neighborhood. How come?
Well, I met a woman who took in boarders, a woman named Mrs. Barber, and she invited me to stay there. I thought it would be a tremendously bad idea because I thought that I would be viewed as a partisan because I would be living in a partisan neighborhood. But I had a reservation on an apartment that was open in 2 weeks, and I thought I could stick it out for 2 weeks, get a feel for the community, and then move out. I would be better off than other journalists who were living full-time in more peaceful areas. Well, I moved in for 2 weeks and found that no one behaved peculiarly toward me because of my place of residence, at least initially. You know, the Protestant community didn't usually ask me where I lived, and if they asked me, I told them I lived across the street from Mackey's, which is a large foundry in a Catholic area that employs mostly Protestants, so I could get a favorable reaction from that. The British didn't seem to pay much attention to where I was living, and my neighbors, while initially probably suspicious, I think came to accept that I wasn't up to do them any harm, and so I stayed.
You're an American of Irish descent, and you're also Catholic. Did you identify with the Catholic point of view?
I think that, first, I don't count myself as a practicing Catholic, although there is the theory that once a Catholic, always a Catholic. I'd like to think that I had set that aside. Did I identify with the Catholic point of view? I did, and I think that I also identified with the Protestant point of view in that I can understand exactly why they're so afraid of a united Ireland. They have very good reason to be afraid of a united Ireland. And I could identify with the point of view of the British soldier on the street, who, by and large, isn't enjoying himself. He comes from a working-class community, much like the ones he's patrolling. He's not welcome in a neighborhood that looks much like the one he grew up in. And I'm sure that's quite a shock.
You know, you even had a moment of commiseration with one of the British soldiers. And then you saw him again the other day, and he waved at you, and you felt you really couldn't wave back in case somebody saw.
Yes, that's the dilemma you're in that neighborhood. You really walk a thin line between being alive and being a human being. And a human reaction would be to say hello. But to fraternize with the troops or with policemen in that neighborhood was not a healthy thing to do.
Once on the street, you were asked by a Protestant teenage girl whether you were Catholic or Protestant, and you said you were Jewish. Could you explain that?
This is not an incident that I still feel guilty about this. It was a sort of a riot situation. I approached a bonfire on the 11th of July. The 12th of July is a great Protestant holiday in the North, celebrating the victory of King William over King James in 1690. It's really a holiday celebrating the subjugation of Catholics. And at this bonfire, the young woman saw me come up from the Catholic side of the road, and she accused me, she turned around and yelled, "He's a tag," meaning he's a Catholic. She then approached me and asked me if I was Catholic or Protestant. I said I was an American, which had always worked in the past. At that point, she was not satisfied, asked if I was Catholic or Protestant, and my thought afterward was I should have said, "Listen, I don't go to a different church than the one that you don't go to, and we both live in the same houses, we both eat the same food, you're no different than I am." But instead, I said I was Jewish. It was an act of self-preservation, but not one that I'm particularly proud of.
That's another example of how you feel that it's impossible to win, to maintain a certain, I don't know if integrity is the word, but to maintain an empathy and survive.
Yes, very difficult to not get boxed in one corner or the other. If it seems in Northern Ireland, there's a question: what foot does he dig with? It's a way of asking what religion the person is. And in Northern Ireland, it seems you have to dig with one foot or the other. You have to be Catholic or Protestant, or it's very difficult to be in the middle.
John Conroy is my guest. He's a journalist based in Chicago. He's written a book titled Belfast Diary, War as a Way of Life, and it's based on the period that he spent in Northern Ireland reporting there. You wrote that every day when you'd walk out of your rooming house, you would be confronted with four different separate forces: the police, the British soldiers, the IRA, and the INLA, which is the Irish National Liberation Army. Did you feel that there was a constant air of terror in the neighborhood that you lived in?
It wasn't a constant fear. It was just always there in the back of your mind that one of the problems with the war there is that you don't know where it is. You know where the war is in Afghanistan. You know where the war is in Iran, Iraq. You don't know where the war is going to be in Northern Ireland. And so no matter what you do, you're always a little bit uneasy, and it has this strange carryover of, I remember coming back to Chicago and walking into a cloakroom at a restaurant where there were a lot of attaché cases left unattended, and I thought, my first reaction was, I've got to get out of here. This place is dangerous. And I think that you pick up attitudes that, again, attitudes of how am I going to survive? I'm not going to hang around any unattended luggage or a car parked in a suspicious place I'm going to give wide berth to. It's a strange place because you go out and you buy the newspaper, the milk is delivered to the door every morning, the bread is in the shops. There's so much that's normal there that it's just a very bizarre place to be.
In the Catholic neighborhood that you lived in while you were in Northern Ireland, in Belfast, you said that there was a kind of subculture that had grown up, in part because the only people left there were poor and uneducated and the middle-class people who had education and the means left a long time ago.
Yes, that's one of the reasons why there's a subculture. Another reason is because the area is walled off. It's separated from the rest of the city by barricades and peace lines and gates, all installed by the security forces. And one is made to feel part of a separate subculture there. And this subculture has bizarre... there are just examples that would curl your hair. There's a club in West Belfast where IRA veterans drink called the Felons Association. Nobody regards with dismay someone who's spent time in jail. That's something to be viewed. That's an honor in West Belfast. And there are pop songs. There's one song called Jesus and Jesse James. It's a country western song. Jesus and Jesse are riding through Belfast, and Jesus sees the tangle of barbed wire, and he says he never thought he'd see the like of Calvary again. And he raises his hand to bless the place, and he's winged by a bullet, which prompts the remark, "I guess that old stigmata is infectious in this land." And the final verse of the song is, "A multitude assembled, and a spokesman up and said, just give us back our country, and to hell with the fish and bread."
You know, another aspect of the subculture, as you describe it, is that the young adults there and the teenagers grew up with the Troubles. So for throughout, as long as they were alive, they were used to this kind of embattled way of life. Did you notice a difference in the people who grew up with the Troubles and those who had grown up, you know, before that, who had experienced another way of life as well?
Yeah, I think there's a definite difference, and you can see it in the voting patterns. The young have a tendency to vote for Sinn Féin, the political wing of the IRA, where the older people are more moderate and vote in greater numbers for the Social Democratic and Labour Party, a Catholic party that wants a united Ireland by peaceful means. The young people, I think Sinn Féin makes Britain sit up and take notice, whereas Britain pays no attention to the SDLP except when it realizes that Sinn Féin's power is growing by leaps and bounds and they had better do something to make the SDLP appear to have some clout with Mrs. Thatcher and Downing Street.
It sounds like there's just a lot of vandalism and violent crime done by the children of the war, the children who grew up in this air of in this atmosphere of violence, and that a lot of the people are very afraid of teenage vandalism. A lot of the businesses are robbed by teenage vandals, and the way you describe it, there's part of what the IRA does is discipline the teenagers.
Yes, it's something they do reluctantly, but they do nonetheless. For lack of any jails, they discipline the teenagers by shooting them in the legs. For a serious crime, for a not so serious crime, you're shot in the thigh, the fleshy part of the thigh. For a more serious crime, you're shot in the knee, which could damage bones and arteries. For more serious crimes, you're shot in both knees, and usually after you've been kneecapped once, if you haven't changed your ways, you can be shot in both knees and both elbows, which is facetiously referred to as getting the Silver Cross.
Now, how is this regarded among the people in Northern Ireland? I mean, the Catholics who might even support the IRA. How is this disciplining regarded?
Well, it's people outside the ghetto are usually horrified by it. People inside the ghetto are pretty accustomed to it. In many ways, they're numb. In other ways, they put up with it because they don't believe that the police force is a much better guardian of public order than the IRA is. And so they would rather go to the IRA than go to the Royal Ulster Constabulary.
And does it help keep the peace?
Well, that's the funny thing. It doesn't, in that kids have lost their fear of being kneecapped. They've lost their fear of the IRA. They've almost lost their fear of death. So that you do have people who have been kneecapped more than once. And there has been this problem when I was over there that you've got government compensation if you're a victim of terrorist crime, so that some of the kids kneecapped came into, a small amount of money by American standards, maybe $2,000 to $4,000. I'm estimating these figures rather roughly, but nonetheless, it was more money than they'd probably ever see again in their lives. So not only were you looked up to by your gang for having been kneecapped by the IRA, you were also perhaps a little bit better off economically for it.
My guest is journalist John Conroy, and he's written a new book titled Belfast Diary, War as a Way of Life. And it's based on a series of visits that he made to report on Northern Ireland. He was there over a period of time between 1980 and 1985. We'll talk more about his observations in Northern Ireland after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Journalist John Conroy is my guest, author of Belfast Diary. You were in Belfast during the hunger strikes, and you were there when Bobby Sands died at the end of his hunger strike. And there was rioting that broke out. There was rioting on your streets. And your house, the rooming house that you were staying in, was actually taken over for a day by members of the IRA. Could you describe how they did that?
Yes. Two women came to the front door and rang the bell. I answered the door, and they asked to use the phone. We had one of the few phones in the district, and it was a coin box. It was a coin-operated phone. So it wasn't unusual for someone to come and ask to use the phone. I didn't recognize the two women, but then I didn't know everyone in the neighborhood either. So I was happy to let them in, and I went into the front room where I worked and shut the door to give them some privacy. And they, and a few minutes later, I'm typing away, and my landlady comes in and sits down next to me, and I look at her, and she looks sick. She looks pale. Then I sense there's someone else in the room, and I turn around, and this red-haired woman whom I've let in is now wearing a pair of wraparound sunglasses and pointing a gun at my head. And she says, "Provisional IRA, we're taking over the house." They then let in a group of men from the alley and proceeded to put a bomb in the building next door with the intention of blowing up some soldiers who would come to stand next to that building in the course of dealing with a riot.
Did you fear for your life?
Well, the problem was that I didn't know what was going on. We were being held at gunpoint in one room, and all the bomb-making action was taking place in the kitchen with the door shut. So I assumed it was for some reason, I thought it was going to be a sniper operation. And when they told us to get on the floor, I thought it was because there's going to be incoming fire from the alley. And I can't say that I was, I certainly wasn't at ease, I can tell you that. I was quite, I was scared. I was very scared.
Well, as I recall, the bombs never went off next door.
Well, the first night, they pushed the button and nothing happened. And they came back and ran through the whole operation again the following evening. And they had a walkie-talkie operation going, which allowed them to know when the soldiers were in position. And when they got word over the walkie-talkie to push the button on the second night, our guard looked out the front window and saw that there were kids who had come up and were taunting the soldiers. And he said into the walkie-talkie, "Can't you see there's kids there?" And apparently the man on the other end of the walkie-talkie couldn't from his vantage point. And so they didn't press the button.
Were you impressed with that? You know, that they didn't bomb it because the children would have been hurt? Were you surprised by that?
No, I wasn't. It would have been such a disaster in terms of... there's two ways to look at the way the IRA operates. One is that they're like politicians, and they respond to what their community can put up with, and the Catholic community couldn't put up with that sort of thing. The other way to look at it is that the IRA is this community. The IRA comes out of this community and has the same horror about civilian casualties and the death of children that their neighbors do. So either way, it didn't surprise me that the IRA didn't do it.
Now, the IRA told you when they left, when they pulled out of the house after they had taken it over, they told you not to tell the police, that they didn't hurt you, but the IRA would hurt you if you went to the police. And you didn't go to the police. I imagine it was a very difficult decision for you to make.
It was a horrible decision. It's the worst I've ever been in. To do nothing was to take a side. There I am trying to work as a journalist, and there was no right decision there. And ultimately, I decided that while I could have gone to the police, had I believed that the police were legitimate guardians of the public order, which anyone who knows Northern Ireland history would have questions about. Amnesty International questioned itself both lately and 9 years ago. And so going to them didn't seem like the right thing to do. And yet not to go to them was in a way to take a side. And ultimately, it seemed, though, that my landlady would suffer for anything that I did, that I could have gone to the police and then left Northern Ireland. But she would have been there to deal with the consequences. And while she might have been able to convince the IRA that it wasn't her that had gone to the police, that doesn't mean that an angry neighbor, maybe whose son was arrested or whose brother was arrested or whose cousin was arrested as a result of my having gone to the police, could not have thrown a petrol bomb through the window and ruined Mrs. Barber's home, put her out of a neighborhood that she lived in for most of her adult life.
In the short time that you were in Northern Ireland, you were up against some pretty impossible situations like the one you just mentioned, where you felt that no decision was really going to be a very good decision. If you expand that a lot, I guess you get the situation in Northern Ireland.
Exactly, yes. My problem with Northern Ireland is that, or with the worldview of Northern Ireland, is that while some people throw up their hands and say there is no good decision there, most people simply don't think about it, and that includes the British public at large. And I think that's the... If I had one goal in writing this book, it would be to raise the level of public awareness about what's going on in Northern Ireland in hopes that if people think about it, they can then study what the various options are with... and not accept simplistic answers when one asks what would happen if this option were tried or that option were tried.
Do you have an option that you believe in?
Yes. I believe that, as I said, that the British should think about the problem. They don't think about it now. It's not an issue in British elections. It's not debated in the House of Parliament. And that, to me, is one of the worst aspects of the whole thing, that it's only an atrocity like yesterday's that grabs the attention of Britain and the rest of the world. And by Friday, Northern Ireland life will be just as it was before this incident.
So that's what you'd like to see, more public debate and political debate on Northern Ireland?
Yes.
Okay, well, John Conroy, thank you for sharing your impressions with us, and thank you for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Journalist John Conroy has been my guest, and he reports from Chicago. He was based in Northern Ireland, stayed in a Catholic neighborhood on and off for a series of about 5 years, from 1980 to 1985, and he's written a new book based on his observations there. It's called Belfast Diary, War as a Way of Life. It's just been published by the Beacon Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.